32 years ago, abortion was legalized in the United States as a result of the Supreme Court's ruling in the landmark Roe v. Wade case. Last week, Sandra Day O'Connor announced that she will step down from the Supreme Court, creating the first vacancy on the court in over a decade. The Bush government will now have the opportunity to appoint a far right-wing Supreme Court justice, paving the way for the overturn of Roe v. Wade and other civil rights rulings. Women's rights groups are jumping into emergency mode to voice opposition to a radical right-wing nominee. But in the meantime, on a daily basis, marginalized women face the realities of reproductive health in the United States, where even legislated rights have severe limitations. I've been joined on the phone by Nkenje Touré. She is a member of the management circle of the Sister Song Women of Color Reproductive Health Collective. She's also the producer and the host of In Our Voices, a women's public affairs program on WPFW Radio in Washington, D.C. Good morning, Nkenje.
Well, good morning and good afternoon if you're here.
So even though abortion has been legal in the United States for over 30 years, do all women have the same access to abortion services if they choose them?
No, all women don't have the same access because it depends, you know, on your socioeconomic levels. It depends on where you live, if you have health insurance, if you don't have health insurance. All of those are, you know, strong factors.
What are some of the barriers specifically that you and other groups you work with in the Sister Song Collective, what are the barriers that you see that make it more difficult for women of color and poor women to access abortion services?
Well, you have women who are undocumented workers who are here, who have language issues, who have issues of fear in terms of coming forth to seek out any kind of assistance with various things. You have women who do not have health insurance for whatever reasons, who live in neighborhoods or areas where there is no actual real access to health care. So, and you also have the situation of education, you know, people not necessarily, women not necessarily being aware of where they might be able to go to acquire certain services.
Are there additional challenges that women on welfare face?
In terms of, if you are a woman who's on welfare, who receives TANF, then it's most likely that you have some sort of health care, Medicaid, some sort of health care for yourself and your children. Now, the quality of that care may certainly be a question, or the limitations of it in terms of where you could go to seek out the health care that you need.
And are abortion services even included in federally funded family planning programs that low-income women would be accessing?
I believe that depends on where you are. For instance, in D.C. every time the budget for the district is developed, there's always a clause in there where the District of Columbia chooses to pay for to fund its own abortions because the federal government does not want to do it, and they often tie it to our budget.
And so what are the health consequences and the social consequences of these disparities in access?
There are obviously a lot of disparities. Those disparities have a lot of consequences. I mean, if you have women, for instance, who don't have access to the health care, that means that they're not going to be as healthy. Their children are not going to be as healthy. Their children are not necessarily going to be as attentive in school. You have situations where if a woman wants to work, for instance, if you're going to work, you want to be able to, as a result of working, be able to live inside of an environment that you consider to be a safe environment. But she may not even be able to work because of the fact that she cannot afford childcare for her children. So therefore, she is unable to have a job. What you see is just cycles of you know, deprivation, I guess you could say, that people experience by not being able to have the access that they need to different things. The fact that you come later to knowledge of any kinds of illnesses that you have, not necessarily just having to do with reproductive health and sexual issues, but certainly there, because it would be much later when you perhaps find out that you have maybe a sexually transmitted disease, or that you have cancer, or that you have fibroids, or any number of things, because you're not getting checked all the time. You don't do well woman appointments.
Some more mainstream groups are talking these days with a focus that's really on abortion rights. And in contrast, your group, the Sister Song Women of Color Reproductive Health Collective, talks about these issues in terms of reproductive justice. What's the difference in your mind between those two frameworks?
Reproductive justice is a much more encompassing conception of what would be involved in reproductive health, reproductive rights, etc. Reproductive justice are these things that you are entitled to have, that is not only focused upon abortion, but it's focused upon the spectrum of reproductive health and reproductive safety, reproductive sexuality, that hold from the right to have a free and safe abortion to the right to receive quality pre- and postnatal care if you decide that you are going to have, that you want to have a child, that you're going to have a child. The right to have contraceptives until such time as you decide to have a child. You know, when your family and your life is in a place that you are prepared and you are ready for that, that you have sex education and available for teens that is not just abstinence-based, but includes the spectrum or a number of other options in regard to how you prevent pregnancy, how you prevent disease, how you take care of yourself. There's a lot of aspects to reproductive justice that are beyond or not just only inclusive of abortion.
And why is this a particularly important framework for women of color?
Because we are along the spectrum in our lives. There are women who, because of their situation, they may need an abortion. Usually if someone gets an abortion, they don't want an abortion. They feel that this is the choice that they have got to make, not that they want it, but that this is what they're going to have to do. At the same time, there are people who want to have children. You want those children to be born healthy. You want that mother to be able to be healthy so she can bring a healthy child into the world. So therefore, the access to health care, a place to get the health care, a means of receiving the health care is critical. If you are a young person making decisions about your life, understanding that there are consequences for everything, and knowing that young people don't really understand or accept yet that there are consequences for all your actions and all your choices, if they're being educated around sexual health, around prevention, around all of those things, they need to have a model that is not abstinence-only based. Yes, they need to know that abstinence only is a way to go. They also need to know where and how to go if they choose not to go abstinence only.
Do you think that Sister Song and other women of color organizations have been able to push the mainstream pro-choice movement to start understanding and integrating reproductive justice into the way that they talk about this work?
I believe that we have demonstrated the need for them to do that, and if not to do that, that we've demonstrated the need for them to begin to consider it. It needs to be done, so you have to start somewhere. I believe that the march last year, which had you know, more than 1 million people participating, and a huge number of women of color through the efforts of Sister Song, through the efforts of New Voices, which we put together for the purpose of reaching out to more women of color and communities of color in different places. We had about 150 women of color organizations and community organizations, you know, from within communities of color that endorsed the march. You had coalition across labor, health care, child care. You had, you know, the anti-war, the peace people coming together because there is common ground there, and particularly if you look at reproductive justice in a human rights framework. So I think that it's not just, I think for the mainstream movement, it's a matter of paying attention and playing catch-up, you know, more than anything else, that that's a choice that they need to make. But if they want their movement to expand and be able to move forward in such a way that, in fact, brings them the goals, the achievement of the goals that they have set out for, they will have to expand their definition.
And finally, what has been the reaction of Sister Song and the member groups that form the collective to the vacancy on the Supreme Court?
Well, of course, we are very, you know, we are very saddened and distressed by that. We recognize Sandra Day O'Connor as a balancing and sort of moderating force there. But what we believe is that whomever comes in as the next justice must be an individual who is willing to protect individual human and civil rights. That is critical, that that person be willing to protect the human and civil rights of individuals.
Well, thank you very much for joining us, Nkenje.
Thank you, Lisa.
I've been speaking with Nkenje Touré of the Sister Song Women of Color Reproductive Health Collective. She's also the host and producer of In Our Voices, a women's public affairs program on WPFW Radio in Washington, D.C. Sister Song's website is www.sistersong.net.